Law of Success, Revised and Updated, Volume 4. Napoleon Hill and the Napoleon Hill Foundation. Edited by Ann Hartley and Bill Hartley. The Principles of Personal Integrity. Cooperation. Profiting by Failure. Tolerance. The Golden Rule. The Universal Law of Cosmic Habit Force. Dedicated to Andrew Carnegie, who suggested the writing of the course, and to Henry Ford, whose astounding achievements formed the foundation for practically all of the lessons of the course, and to Edwin C. Barnes, a business associate of Thomas A. Edison, whose close personal friendship over a period of more than 15 years served to help me carry on in the face of a great variety of adversities and much temporary defeat met with in organizing the course. Tributes to Law of Success from Great American Leaders. The publishers feel that you will realize more keenly the enormous value of these lessons if you first hear a few tributes from great leaders in finance, science, invention, and political life. Supreme Court of the United States, Washington, D.C. My dear Mr. Hill, I have now had an opportunity to finish reading your Law of Success textbooks, and I wish to express my appreciation of the splendid work you have done in this philosophy. It would be helpful if every politician in the country would assimilate and apply the 15 principles upon which the Law of Success is based. It contains some very fine material which every leader in every walk of life should understand. Signed, William H. Taft, former President of the United States and Chief Justice. Laboratory of Thomas A. Edison. My dear Mr. Hill, allow me to express my appreciation of the compliment you have paid me in sending me the original manuscript of Law of Success. I can see you have spent a great deal of time and thought in its preparation. Your philosophy is sound, and you are to be congratulated for your sticking to your work over so long a period of years. Your students will be amply rewarded for their labor. Signed, Thomas A. Edison. Public Ledger, Philadelphia. Dear Mr. Hill, thank you for your Law of Success. It is great stuff. I shall finish reading it. I would like to reprint that story, What I Would Do If I Had $1,000,000, in the business section of the Public Ledger. Signed, Cyrus H. K. Curtis, publisher of Saturday Evening Post, Ladies' Home Journal. King of the 5 and 10 cent stores. By applying many of the 15 fundamentals of the Law of Success philosophy, we have built a great chain of successful stores. I presume it would be no exaggeration of fact if I said that the Woolworth Building might properly be called a monument to the soundness of these principles. Signed, F. W. Woolworth. Historic American Labor Leader. Mastery of the Law of Success philosophy is the equivalent of an insurance policy against failure. Signed, Samuel Gompers. A Former President. May I congratulate you on your persistence. Any man who devotes that much time must, of necessity, make discoveries of great value to others. I am deeply impressed by your interpretation of the mastermind principles which you have so clearly described. Signed, Woodrow Wilson. A Department Store Founder. I know that your 15 fundamentals of success are sound because I have been applying them in my business for more than 30 years. Signed, John Wanamaker. From the founder of Kodak. I know that you are doing a world of good with your Law of Success. I would not care to set a monetary value on this training because it brings to the student qualities which cannot be measured by money alone. Signed, George Eastman. A Food and Candy Chief. Whatever success I may have attained, I owe entirely to the application of your 15 fundamental principles of the Law of Success. I believe I have the honor of being your first student. Signed, William Wrigley, Jr. The law of success is comprised of the key principles that form the foundation of Napoleon Hill's philosophy of personal achievement. This newly revised and updated edition, the first to include all 17 principles, is published in 4 separate volumes, each volume devoted to a specific set of those principles. In its first edition, The Law of Success presented 15 principles. In later editions, the number was expanded to 16 as Hill came to believe that the mastermind, which had been part of the introduction to the first edition, was in fact a separate principle unto itself. Later still, he concluded that there was another key principle that in effect unified the others. This newly recognized principle he termed Cosmic Habit Force, which, when he began working with W. Clement Stone, was also referred to as the Universal Law. The genesis of the 4 principles explored in this third volume, and the other principles that complete the Law of Success, date from the day in 1908 when Napoleon Hill was assigned to write a magazine profile on steel baron and philanthropist Andrew Carnegie. During their interview, Carnegie became so impressed with the young writer that what was to have been a brief interview stretched into a 3-day marathon. It concluded with Carnegie offering to introduce Napoleon Hill to the most powerful men of the day in order that Hill could learn from each of them the secrets of their success. It was Carnegie's vision that, in so doing, Hill could formulate a philosophy that could be used by anyone to help themselves to create their own success and realize their dreams. As Napoleon Hill pursued his mission, the material he was gathering and the lessons he was learning truly became his life's definite chief aim. He wrote thousands of articles and profiles, launched his own magazines, developed home study courses, started training centers, and opened a business college, all inspired by his evolving philosophy. And he created a lecture series that brought him wide recognition as an inspiring public speaker on the subject of success and personal achievement. Through it all, Napoleon Hill was constantly testing and modifying his theories until they became refined into a set of specific principles that together formed the cohesive philosophy Andrew Carnegie had envisioned. In 1928, drawing upon the interviews and research he had compiled and the materials he had written during his 20-year quest, Napoleon Hill finally assembled what would become the first edition of The Law of Success. Then, in what proved to be a brilliant marketing concept, his publisher chose to release it not as a single book, but as a set of 8 volumes. The entire collection was an immediate and astounding success, as were later editions which presented all of the principles in 1 volume. Over the years, there have been at least 5 authorized editions that revised or added material, and in its various forms, it has been reprinted more than 50 times. In preparing this revised and updated edition of The Law of Success, the editors have attempted to allow Hill to be as modern an author as if he were still among us, and we have treated the text as we would the text of a living author. When we encountered what modern grammarians would consider run-on sentences, outdated punctuation, or other matters of form, we opted for contemporary usage. If something was obscure or misleading because the author's language was idiosyncratic or archaic, or when it might be construed as out of step with modern thinking, minor alterations were made. A more challenging problem was the question of how to update the actual content of the book. In carefully reviewing the original text, it became clear that the answer was not to simply replace the examples cited by Hill with similar stories about contemporary people. The anecdotes and examples used by Napoleon Hill were so integral to the point being made, or the principle being discussed, that to replace them just for the sake of having a more contemporary name would do nothing to make it better. The editors concluded that the best course was to instead augment with additional stories that would serve as confirmation that the Law of Success is a living philosophy. The additional examples have been judiciously inserted as reminders that the principles upon which the Law of Success is based were relevant in 1928, they were still applicable 75 years later in 2003, and they will no doubt continue to be relevant and applicable for at least the next 75 years. In addition to the contemporary examples, where the editors feel it would be of interest to the listener, we have also included marginal notes that provide background information, historical context, and, where applicable, we have suggested books that complement various aspects of Napoleon Hill's philosophy. All new material that has been added to the original text will be clearly identified in this recording as commentary from the editors. Throughout the preparation of this most recent and revised updated edition, the editors have enjoyed the complete cooperation of the Napoleon Hill Foundation and the Napoleon Hill World Learning Center. With their assistance, we have drawn upon the previous editions of the work, as well as on other books and materials written by Napoleon Hill, in order to incorporate the final evolution of his philosophy and thereby present the most complete and comprehensive edition of The Law of Success. The editors, Anne Hartley and Bill Hartley. The author's acknowledgement of help rendered him in the writing of this course. This course is the result of careful analysis of the life work of over 100 men and women who have achieved unusual success in their respective callings. I have spent more than 20 years in gathering, classifying, testing, and organizing the lessons upon which the course is based. In this labor, I have received valuable assistance either in person or by studying the life work of the following: Henry Ford, Thomas A. Edison, Harvey S. Firestone, John D. Rockefeller, Charles M. Schwab, Woodrow Wilson, Darwin P. Kingsley, William Wrigley Jr., A. D. Lasker, E. A. Filene, James J. Hill, Edward Bach, Cyrus H. K. Curtis, George W. Perkins, Henry L. Doherty, George S. Parker, Dr. C. O. Henry, General Rufus A. Ayers, Judge Elbert H. Gary, William Howard Taft, Dr. Elmer Gates, John W. Davis, Captain George M. Alexander, to whom I was formerly an assistant, Hugh Chalmers, Dr. E. W. Strickler, Edwin C. Barnes, Robert L. Taylor, Fiddling Bob, George Eastman, E. M. Statler, Andrew Carnegie, John Wanamaker, Marshall Field, Samuel Gompers, F. W. Woolworth, Judge Daniel T. Wright, one of my law instructors, Elbert Hubbard, Luther Burbank, O. H. Harriman, John Burroughs, E. H. Harriman, Charles P. Steinmetz, Frank Vanderlip, Theodore Roosevelt, William H. French, and Dr. Alexander Graham Bell, to whom I owe credit for most of Lesson 1. Of the people named, perhaps Henry Ford and Andrew Carnegie should be acknowledged as having contributed most toward the building of this course, for the reason that it was Andrew Carnegie who first suggested the writing of the course, and Henry Ford, whose life work supplied much of the material out of which the course was developed. I have studied the majority of these people at close range, in person. With many of them, I enjoy, or did enjoy before their death, the privilege of close personal friendship which enabled me to gather from their philosophy facts that would not have been available under other conditions. With the exception of the psychological law referred to in Lesson 1 as the mastermind, I don't claim to have created anything basically new in this course. What I have done, however, has been to organize old truths and known laws into practical, usable form, where they may be properly interpreted and applied by the workaday person whose needs call for a philosophy of simplicity. The student of this course is warned against passing judgment upon it before having listened to the entire 17 lessons. The listener who takes up this course with an open mind and sees to it that his or her mind remains open until the last lesson is finished will be richly rewarded with a broader and more accurate view of life as a whole. Napoleon Hill. A Personal Statement by Napoleon Hill, from the 1928 edition. Some 30 years ago, a young clergyman by the name of Gunsellus announced in the newspapers of Chicago that he would preach a sermon the following Sunday morning entitled, "What I Would Do If I Had $1,000,000." The announcement caught the eye of Philip D. Armour, the wealthy packing house king, who decided to hear the sermon. In his sermon, Dr. Gunsellus pictured a great school of technology where young men and young women could be taught how to succeed in life by developing the ability to think in practical rather than in theoretical terms, where they would be taught to learn by doing. If I had $1 million, said the young preacher, I would start such a school. After the sermon was over, Mr. Armour walked down the aisle to the pulpit, introduced himself, and said, Young man, I believe you could do all you said you could, and if you will come down to my office tomorrow morning, I will give you $1 million you need. There is always plenty of capital for those who can create practical plans for using it. That was the beginning of the Armour Institute of Technology, one of the very practical schools of the country. The school was born in the imagination of a young man who never would have been heard outside of the community in which he preached had it not been for the imagination plus the capital of Philip D. Armour. Commentary from the editors. The Armour Institute of Technology opened in 1893, offering courses in engineering, chemistry, architecture, and library science, and in 1940 became the Illinois Institute of Technology when the Armour Institute merged with the Lewis Institute, a Chicago college that had opened in 1895 and offered liberal arts as well as science and engineering courses. In 1949, the Institute of Design, founded in 1937, also merged with Illinois Institute of Technology, followed in 1969 by the Chicago-Kent College of Law and the Stewart School of Business, and in 1986 by the Midwest College of Engineering. Today, there are several campuses in downtown Chicago. Illinois Institute of Technology has been called the alma mater of accomplishments. Resuming Napoleon Hill's original text. Every great railroad and every outstanding financial institution and every mammoth business enterprise and every great invention began in the imagination of some one person. F. W. Woolworth created the 5- and 10-cent stores plan in his imagination before it became a reality and made him a multimillionaire. Thomas A. Edison created sound recorders, movies, the electric light bulb, and scores of other useful inventions in his own imagination before they became a reality. After the Chicago fire, scores of merchants whose stores went up in smoke stood near the smoldering embers of their former places of business, grieving over their loss. Many of them decided to go away into other cities and start over again. In the group was Marshall Field, who saw, in his own imagination, the world's greatest retail store, standing on the same spot where his former store had stood, which was then but a ruined mass of smoking timbers. That store became a reality. Fortunate is the young man or young woman who learns early in life to use imagination, and doubly so in this age of greater opportunity. Imagination is a faculty of the mind that can be cultivated, developed, extended, and broadened by use. If this were not true, this course on the laws of success never would have been created, because it was first conceived in my imagination from the mere seed of an idea which was sown by a chance remark of the late Andrew Carnegie. Wherever you are, whoever you are, whatever you may be following as an occupation, there is room for you to make yourself more useful, and in that manner more productive, by developing and using your imagination. Success in this world is always a matter of individual effort, yet you will only be deceiving yourself if you believe that you can succeed without the cooperation of other people. Success is a matter of individual effort only to the extent that each person must decide, in his or her own mind, what is wanted. This involves the use of imagination. From this point on, achieving success is a matter of skillfully and tactfully inducing others to cooperate. Before you can secure cooperation from others, before you have the right to ask for or expect cooperation from other people, you must first show a willingness to cooperate with them. For this reason, the 9th lesson of this course, The Habit of Doing More Than Paid For, is one which should have your serious and thoughtful attention. The law upon which this lesson is based would, of itself, practically ensure success to all who practice it in all they do. The purpose of the Law of Success course is to enable you to find out how you may become more capable in your chosen field of work. You may not like the work in which you are now engaged. There are two ways of getting out of that work. One way is to take little interest in it and do just enough to get by. Very soon you will find a way out, because the demand for your services will cease. The other and better way is by making yourself so useful and efficient in what you are now doing that you will attract the favorable attention of those who have the power to promote you into more responsible work that is more to your liking. It is your privilege to take your choice as to which way you will proceed. Thousands of people walked over the Great Calumet Copper Mine without discovering it. Just one lone man used his imagination, dug down into the earth a few feet, investigated, and discovered the richest copper deposit on earth. You and every other person walk, at one time or another, over your Calumet Mine. Discovery is a matter of investigation and use of imagination. This course on the laws of success may lead the way to your Calumet. And you may be surprised when you discover that you were standing right over this rich mine in the work in which you are now engaged. In his lecture, Acres of Diamonds, Russell Conwell tells us that we need not seek opportunity in the distance, that we may find it right where we stand. This is a truth well worth remembering. Napoleon Hill. Lesson 13. Cooperation. You can do it if you believe you can. Cooperation is the beginning of all organized effort. As was stated in the second lesson, volume 1 of this course, Andrew Carnegie accumulated a gigantic fortune through the cooperative efforts of a small group of men, numbering not more than 20. You, too, can learn how to use this principle. There are two forms of cooperation that will be discussed in this lesson. The first is the cooperation between people who group themselves together or form alliances for the purpose of attaining a given end, under the principles known as the Law of the Mastermind, Lesson 1, Volume 1. The second is the cooperation between the conscious and the subconscious minds, which is the basis upon which I have built my hypothesis that we can develop the ability to contact, communicate with, and draw upon infinite intelligence. Although the foregoing hypothesis may seem unreasonable to you at this point, study the facts upon which the hypothesis is based, and then draw your own conclusions. Let us begin with a brief review of the physical construction of the body. Editor's Commentary. In the material that follows, Napoleon Hill quotes from the Edinburgh Lectures on Mental Science by Judge Thomas Troward. The book was first published in 1909 and most recently reprinted in 1989 in paperback. The reviews on Amazon.com are relatively current and generally favorable, despite new theories having been developed since it was first written and despite some of the rather archaic writing. A review posted in 2002 says that it's very easy to understand and calls it a classic by one of the pioneers of new thought. That reviewer also recommends Troward's masterpiece, The Creative Process in the Individual. A 2000 review calls it half philosophy, half science, saying the premise condensed down to three words is faith changes reality. And a 1998 review also recommends Your Invisible Power by Geneviève Berend, Troward's student, saying that her book outlining the same principles is more basic. Continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. We know that the whole body is traversed by a network of nerves which serve as the channels of communication between the indwelling spiritual ego, which we call mind, and the functions of the external organism. This nervous system is dual. One system, known as the sympathetic, is the channel for all those activities which are not consciously directed by our volition, such as the operation of the digestive organs, the repair of the daily wear and tear of the tissues, and the like. The other system, known as the voluntary or cerebrospinal system, is the channel through which we receive conscious perception from the physical senses and exercise control over the movements of the body. This system has its center in the brain, while the other has its center in the ganglionic mass at the back of the stomach, known as the solar plexus, and sometimes spoken of as the abdominal brain. The cerebrospinal system is the channel of our volitional or conscious mental action, and the sympathetic system is the channel of that mental action which unconsciously supports the vital functions of the body. Thus, the cerebrospinal system is the organ of the conscious mind, and the sympathetic is that of the subconscious mind. But the interaction of conscious and subconscious minds requires a similar interaction between the corresponding systems of nerves, and one conspicuous connection by which this is provided is the vagus nerve. This nerve passes out of the cerebral region as a portion of the voluntary system, and through it, we control the vocal organs. Then it passes onward to the thorax, sending out branches to the heart and lungs. And finally, passing through the diaphragm, it loses the outer coating, which distinguishes the nerves of the voluntary system and becomes identified with those of the sympathetic system, so forming a connecting link between the two and making the man physically a single entity. Similarly, different areas of the brain indicate their connection with the objective and subjective activities of the mind respectively. And, speaking in a general way, we may assign the frontal portion of the brain to the former and the posterior portion to the latter, while the intermediate portion partakes of the character of both. The intuitional faculty has its correspondence in the upper area of the brain, situated between the frontal and the posterior portions, and physiologically speaking, it is here that intuitive ideas find entrance. These, at first, are more or less unformed and generalized in character, but are, nevertheless, perceived by the conscious mind. Otherwise, we should not be aware of them at all. Then the effort of nature is to bring these ideas into more definite and usable shape. So the conscious mind lays hold on them and induces a corresponding vibratory current in the voluntary system of nerves, and this in turn induces a similar current in the involuntary system, thus handing the idea over to the subjective mind. The vibratory current, which had first descended from the apex of the brain to the frontal brain, and thus through the voluntary system to the solar plexus, is now reversed, and ascends from the solar plexus through the sympathetic system to the posterior brain. This return current indicating the action of the subjective mind. If we were to remove the surface portion of the apex of the brain, we should find immediately below it the shining belt of brain substance called the corpus callosum. This is the point of union between the subjective and objective, and as the current returns from the solar plexus to this point, it is restored to the objective portion of the brain in a fresh form, which it has acquired by the silent alchemy of the subjective mind. Thus, the conception which was at first only vaguely recognized is restored to the objective mind in a definite and workable form, and then the objective mind, acting through the frontal brain, the area of comparison and analysis, proceeds to work upon a clearly perceived idea and to bring out the potentialities that are latent in it. This completes the excerpt from The Edinburgh Lectures on Mental Science by Judge Thomas Troward. The term subjective mind is the same as the term subconscious mind, and the term objective mind is the same as the term conscious mind. Please understand these different terms. By studying this dual system through which the body transmits energy, we discover the exact points at which the two systems are connected, and the manner in which we may transmit a thought from the conscious to the subconscious mind. This cooperative dual nervous system is the most important form of cooperation known to man, for it is through the aid of this system that the principle of evolution carries on its work of developing accurate thinking, as described in Lesson 11, Volume 3. When you impress any idea on your subconscious mind through the principle of autosuggestion, you do so with the aid of this dual nervous system, and when your subconscious mind works out a definite plan of any desire with which you impress it, the plan is delivered back to your conscious mind through the same dual nervous system. This cooperative system of nerves literally constitutes a direct line of communication between your ordinary conscious mind and infinite intelligence. From the editors. Napoleon Hill discusses infinite intelligence at length in Volume 3 of The Law of Success, as well as in Think and Grow Rich. While the term itself is used only twice in this volume, the concept is frequently applicable. For the benefit of those who may be hearing this volume first, we provide a brief explanation based on Hill's other writings. As he says here, the subconscious mind is the connecting link or intermediary between the conscious mind and infinite intelligence. In Think and Grow Rich, Hill describes infinite intelligence as a power which permeates every atom of matter and embraces every unit of energy perceptible to man, converts acorns into oak trees, causes water to flow downhill in response to the law of gravity, follows night with day and winter with summer, each maintaining its proper place and relationship to the other. This intelligence may, through the principles of this philosophy, be induced to aid in transmuting desires into concrete or material form. This concept will be better understood after listening to the last lesson in this volume. Hill at times refers to infinite intelligence as spirit, and also describes it as the receiving set through which thoughts, ideas, hunches, and inspirations flash into the mind. He says that it is also through infinite intelligence that one may tune in or communicate with the subconscious minds of others. However, he stresses that it is only through faith, by which Hill means conviction or belief, not necessarily religious faith, that the force of infinite intelligence can be accessed and applied. In Think and Grow Rich, Hill writes, "If you pray for a thing, but have fear as you pray that you may not receive it, or that your prayer will not be acted upon by infinite intelligence, your prayer will have been in vain." Resuming Napoleon Hill's original text. Knowing from my own previous experience as a beginner in the study of this subject how difficult it is to accept this hypothesis, I will illustrate the soundness of the hypothesis in a simple way that you can both understand and demonstrate for yourself. Before going to sleep at night, impress upon your mind the desire to arise the next morning at a given hour, say at 4 a.m., and if your impression is accompanied by positive determination to arise at that hour, your subconscious mind will register the impression and awaken you at precisely that time. Now the question might well be asked, if I can impress my subconscious mind with a desire to arise at a specified time, and it will awaken me at that time, why do I not form the habit of impressing it with other and more important desires? If you will ask yourself this question and insist upon an answer, you will find yourself on the pathway that leads to the secret door to knowledge, as described in Lesson 11, Volume 3. The Power of Cooperative Organized Effort. We will now take up the subject of cooperation between those who unite or group themselves together for the purpose of attaining a given end. In the second lesson, Volume 1, I referred to this sort of cooperation as organized effort. This course touches some phase of cooperation in practically every lesson. This was inevitable because one object of the course is to help the student develop power, and power is developed only through organized effort. The three most important factors that enter into the process of organizing effort are concentration, cooperation, and coordination. We are living in an age of cooperative effort. Nearly all successful businesses are conducted under some form of cooperation. The same is true in the field of industry and finance, as well as in the professional field. Doctors and lawyers have their alliances for mutual aid and protection in the form of bar associations and medical associations. Bankers have both local and national associations for their mutual aid and advancement. Retail merchants have their associations for the same purpose. Automobile owners have grouped themselves into clubs and associations. Printers have their associations, and plumbers have theirs. Cooperation is the object of all these associations. The laborers have their unions, and those who supply the working capital and supervise the efforts of laborers have their alliances under various names. It is slowly becoming obvious that those who most efficiently apply the principle of cooperative effort survive longest, and that this principle applies from the lowest form of animal life to the highest form of human endeavor. Mr. Carnegie and Mr. Rockefeller and Mr. Ford have taught the businessman the value of cooperative effort. That is, they have taught all who cared to observe the principle through which they themselves accumulated vast fortunes. Cooperation is the very foundation of all successful leadership. Henry Ford's most tangible asset is the well-organized network of car dealerships that he has established. This organization not only provides him with an outlet for all the automobiles he can manufacture, but of greater importance still, it provides him with financial power sufficient to meet any emergency that may arise. As a result of his understanding of the value of the cooperative principle, Ford has removed himself from the usual position of dependence upon financial institutions and at the same time provided himself with more commercial power than he can possibly use. The chain store systems constitute another form of commercial cooperation that provides advantage through both the purchasing and the distributing end of the business. The modern department store, which is the equivalent of a group of small stores operating under one roof, one management, and one overhead expense, is another illustration of the advantage of cooperative effort in the commercial field. In Lesson 15, you will observe the possibilities of cooperative effort in its highest form, and at the same time, you will see the important part that it plays in the development of power. Personal power is developed by organizing and coordinating the faculties of the mind. This may be accomplished by mastering and applying the 17 major principles upon which this course is founded. The necessary procedure through which these principles may be mastered is thoroughly described in the 16th lesson. The development of personal power is but the first step to be taken in the development of the potential power that is available through the medium of allied effort or cooperation, which may be called group power. It is a well-known fact that all who have amassed large fortunes have been known as able organizers. This means that they possess the ability to enlist the cooperative efforts of others who supplied talent and ability which they themselves did not possess. A chief object of this course is to present the principles of organized and cooperative or allied effort so that you will comprehend their significance and make them the basis of your own philosophy. Take as an example any business or profession that you choose, and you will observe, by analysis, that it is limited only by lack of application of organized and cooperative effort. As an illustration, consider the legal profession. If a law firm consists of only one type of mind, it will be greatly handicapped, even though it may be made up of a dozen able people of this particular type. The complicated legal system calls for a greater variety of talent than any one person could possibly provide. It is evident, therefore, that mere organized effort is not sufficient to ensure outstanding success. The organization must consist of individuals who each supply some specialized talent that the other members of the organization do not have. A well-organized law firm would include talent that was specialized in the preparation of cases, people of vision and imagination who understood how to harmonize the law and the evidence of a case under a sound plan. But those who have such ability do not always have the ability to try a case in court. Therefore, people who are proficient in court procedure must also be available. Carrying the analysis a step further, it will be seen that there are many different types of cases that call for people of various specialized abilities in both the preparation and the trial of these cases. A lawyer who had prepared him or herself as a specialist in corporate law might be wholly unprepared to handle a case in criminal procedure. In forming a law partnership, the person who understood the principles of organized cooperative effort would surround himself with talent that was specialized in every branch of law and legal procedure in which they intended to practice. The person who had no conception of the potential power of these principles would probably select their associates by the usual hit-or-miss method, basing their selections more on personality or acquaintanceship than consideration of the particular type of legal talent that each possessed. The subject of organized effort has been covered in the preceding lessons of this course, but it is again brought up in connection with this lesson for the purpose of indicating the necessity of forming alliances or organizations consisting of individuals who supply all of the necessary talent that may be needed for the attainment of the object in mind. In nearly all commercial undertakings, there is a need for at least three kinds of talent: buyers, salespeople, and those who are familiar with finance. It will be readily seen that when these three organize and coordinate their efforts, they avail themselves, through this form of cooperation, of a power that no single individual of the group has. Many a business fails because all the people behind it are salespeople, or financial people, or buyers. By nature, the most able salespeople are optimistic, enthusiastic, and emotional, while able financial people, as a rule, are unemotional, deliberate, and conservative. Both types are essential to the success of a commercial enterprise, but either will prove too much of a burden for any business without the modifying influence of the other. It is generally conceded that James J. Hill was the most efficient railroad builder that America ever produced. But it is equally well known that he was not a civil engineer, or a bridge builder, or a locomotive engineer, or a mechanical engineer or a chemist, although these highly specialized talents are all essential in railroad building. Mr. Hill understood the principles of organized effort and cooperation. Therefore, he surrounded himself with men who possessed all the necessary ability which he lacked. Analyze power, no matter where or in what form it may be found, and you will find organization and cooperation as the chief factors behind it. You will find these two principles in evidence in the lowest form of vegetation, no less than in the highest form of animal, which is man. Off the coast of Norway is the most famous and irresistible maelstrom in the world. This great whirlpool of ceaseless motion has never been known to give up any victim who was caught in its circling embrace of foaming water. No less sure of destruction are those unfortunate souls who are caught in the great maelstrom of life toward which all who do not understand the principle of organized cooperative effort are traveling. We are living in a world in which the law of the survival of the fittest is everywhere in evidence. Those who are fit are those who have power, and power is organized effort. Unfortunate is the person who, either through ignorance or because of egotism, imagines that they can sail this sea of life on independence. Such a person will discover that there are maelstroms more dangerous than any mere whirlpool of unfriendly waters. All natural laws and all of nature's plans are based upon harmonious cooperative effort, as all who have attained high places in the world have discovered. Wherever people are engaged in unfriendly combat, no matter what may be its nature or its cause, one may observe the nearness of one of these maelstroms that awaits the combatants. Success in life cannot be attained except through peaceful, harmonious, cooperative effort. Nor can success be attained single-handedly or independently. Even a person who lives as a hermit in the wilderness, far from all signs of civilization, is, nevertheless, dependent upon forces outside of themselves for an existence. The more one becomes a part of civilization, the more dependent upon cooperative effort they become. Whether a person earns their living by working or from the interest on the fortune they have amassed, they will earn it with less opposition through friendly cooperation with others. Moreover, the person whose philosophy is based upon cooperation instead of competition will not only acquire the necessities and the luxuries of life with less effort, but they will also enjoy an extra reward in happiness such as others will never feel. Fortunes that are acquired through cooperative effort inflict no scars on the hearts of their owners, which is more than can be said of fortunes that are acquired through conflict and competitive methods that border on extortion. The accumulation of material wealth, whether the object is that of bare existence or luxury, consumes most of the time that we put into this earthly struggle. If we cannot change this materialistic tendency of human nature, we can, at least, change the method of pursuing it by adopting cooperation as the basis of the pursuit. Cooperation offers the twofold reward of providing one with both the necessities and the luxuries of life and the peace of mind that the greedy never know. The avaricious and covetous person may amass a great fortune in material wealth, there is no denying this, but they will have sold their soul in the bargain.